Make sure you're subscribed to Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit that subscribe button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for other podcast listeners to find Issues Etc.
Think of socialism as an economic system, but of course it's also a social system. It's equally totalitarian in both of those areas, and in order to achieve its economic goals, it has to first achieve its social or societal goals. This is why socialism inevitably, however it manifests itself, always goes after marriage and the family. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. live on this Friday afternoon, December the 3rd. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about gender, marriage, and socialism with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. She is author of a pamphlet titled The Socialist Attack on the Family. A little later, Cheryl DeWitt will join us from Redeeming Life Outreach. We'll discuss helping women considering abortion. Then many Christians will be singing this Advent hymn, Lo, He Comes with Clouds Descending. We will study it in hour two with Pastor Will Whedon of The Word of the Lord Endures Forever. Joining us to discuss gender, marriage, and socialism, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. She's founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including The Sexual State and a pamphlet titled The Socialist Attack on the Family. Jennifer, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. I've missed you guys.
We've missed you as well. You say it's been long recognized that socialism has designs on marriage and the family, but you say that we shouldn't view socialism's targeting of the family and marriage as a sideshow to its economic aims. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, first of all, the pamphlet that we're about to talk about is something that was based on a talk I gave at the Acton Institute in 2008. Okay, so this is an old process of thought, even for me, okay? And it's only gotten worse, right? But what I mean by that is that when the Berlin Wall fell, a lot of people were very excited. It's like, okay, guys, we proved it. It doesn't work. Socialism doesn't work. Communism doesn't work. Can we please stop? And a lot of people thought, oh, wow, yeah, we'll stay. Yeah, everything's going to be great. We're going to have free markets now. It's going to be free. It's going to be great. But all of those socialists, so many of those socialists, were not slowed down even slightly. They just turned their attention from the economic and directed it over towards the family. And on that front, they have continued to make tremendous strides. And in fact, there is nobody like Ludwig von Mises or Milton Friedman to slow them down, you know. And that continues to be true now, you know, in 2021, however late we are into this process, that is as true today as it was when I first wrote this thing. So the breakdown of the family and the control of the economy, these are all of a piece of the socialist plan or vision or dream, you could say, of centralized control of the society.
Why does socialism always target marriage and the family?
Well, you know, let's put it this way, Todd. It's bigger even than socialism. What you could really say is every totalitarian movement that you can think of has always targeted marriage and the family. And so it's not just socialism. It's not just communism. It's all sorts of these types of totalitarian movements. And the reason is that if you have aspirations to control society, if you have aspirations to have everything centralized under the control of the state, if you have aspirations for world domination, which a lot of these totalitarian movements all obviously have that too, you can't allow these little independent people running around having their own little miniature society in every house. The mother, the father, and their children that they raise together, that's a little society right there. And they don't really need the state very much. They can interact with the rest of society in a peaceful and productive manner, but they don't need the state in order to be sustained. The state cannot allow you to love your mom and dad more than you love the state. The state cannot allow mom and dad to be willing to die for their children. They can't allow that. Everybody's loyalty has to be first and foremost and really ultimately totally to the state. And this is also why these kind of totalitarian movements, they always go after the family. They also always go after the church, because the Christian church always says, you know, look, we'll pay our taxes and stuff, but you're not God, and we're not going along with your plan that you're God. So it's always the same two institutions, the church and the family, that socialism, everywhere it's been tried, and every other totalitarian movement you can think of, going all the way back to the French Revolution, they've always targeted the family and the church.
Explain how socialism itself understands gender in the institution of marriage.
Okay, so now we've got some documentary evidence, okay? And that is, if you go back to Engels, Frederick Engels and Karl Marx, they actually wrote about the family. And, you know, when I was a young economist learning about comparative economic systems, nobody ever bothered to tell us that they had this whole doctrine about the family, in addition to all their doctrine about labor and capital and all of that stuff. And basically what Engels said in his book from the 19th century is, he said that there used to be some wonderful period of time of primitive socialism before there was capitalism, before there was private property. There was also, this was also before monogamy. And monogamy meant that the husband became the ruler of the wife. And this is the beginning of bourgeois society, in the sense that there's a kind of class conflict between men and women that shows up in monogamous marriage. And so the husband is the bourgeois and the wife is the worker, the proletariat. And what is needed is the breakdown of individual private households into a kind of, I don't even know how to describe it, but into a kind of sexual free-for-all, where nobody's taking care of their own kids and nobody's particularly sexually possessive or monogamous. And so that's what they wrote about in the 19th century. And it took until the 20th century for people to really start saying, oh yeah, that sounds like a great plan. Let's try to make that happen. You know, and we now know with what disastrous results have followed from that, because kids actually do need their parents, and parents actually take better care of their own kids than they take care of other people's kids. Kind of like you take better care of your own property than you take care of the commons. It's a little bit similar, but it's much deeper as well. But that's the specific thing that Engels brings to the table that is unique, I think, amongst totalitarian ideologies, that he's willing to just put it on the table and say, having one man and one woman together raising their own children, no, that's bad, and explicitly say that.
What takes the place of marriage under socialism?
Well, the state. The state takes the place of it, okay? Or the, you know, the classless society. They never come out and say it's the state that's going to do it, but in fact, that's what it turns out to be. It's the party. It's the classless society is going to somehow be held together in collective organizations that they don't admit are going to have leadership. Of course, they have to have some kind of leadership, but they never admit that. And so what you end up with is collectivism, of kind of collective care of children and a collective reorganization of loyalties and commitments, personal commitments, that instead of being attached to individuals, you're attached to the mass institution of the state. And so individual affections are supposed to be broken down. You're not a good comrade if you are particularly close to one person or another, something like that. You know, you're supposed to be loyal to the dear leader, that kind of thing. You know, you end up with personality cults. As far as I know, Marxism doesn't have a theory about personality cults, but they have personality cults. That's where it always ends up.
How does socialism seek to abolish gender differences?
Well, that's something new. I don't think Marx and Engels really thought that that was going to happen. I don't think they thought about the significance of the human body. I think what they thought is that if you had an industrial society, the physical differences in strength could be overcome by this wonderful machinery we were going to all have. And if you took care of children in state-run creches, the biological differences between men and women, that was not going to matter very much. So it was all going to be great. It took the 20th century for theorists to come along and say, well, what we really need to do is to aggressively break down the differences between male and female. And so many of the early and more radical feminists, people like Shulamith Firestone and Kate Millett and these kind of people, were greatly influenced by Marxist categories of thought. I don't know how many, I can't answer the question of whether they all thought of themselves as Marxists, but they used Marxist categories for sure. And it's also true that many Marxists, you could say that they're now cultural Marxists, have latched on to different aspects of feminist ideology and now transgender ideology to further the breakdown of the family and sexual differences so that this whole grand picture of a collective society can be brought about. I mean, really, these ideologies, Todd, these ideologies are a pretext for a power grab. That's how I think people should think about it. And that's my more mature view. The pamphlet that I had here is, you know, like I said, written in 2008. Watching things unfold, I've become convinced that the fantasy that ideologues promise is never the point. You must not get too hung up on the fantasy world that they're going to give you, a world of perfect equality and all this. That fantasy is designed to put you to sleep so that you go, oh, wow, I want that. Yeah, I'll do whatever you tell me. You know, kind of a thing. It's a cover story for a power grab. And I think that's the deepest truth about the modern ideologies, including, of course, socialism and communism.
So in that vein, talk about how today's social contagion of gender confusion, just a general term for everything you were describing before about the 21st century manifestation of the sexual revolution, how does that play into socialism's plan?
Well, the gender confusion is deliberately created, okay? The first thing to say about that, Todd, is that it's a special case of my theory that I expound in The Sexual State, which is that the whole sexual revolution is a top-down ideology driven by the elite. There is nothing grassroots about the gender ideology. And I think that should be clear to anybody who's paying attention. There is not some mass movement of teenagers saying, oh gosh, we all want to become boys. Oh gosh, we all want to become girls. No, that's being fed and driven by a combination of propaganda from the top down, from the elites, propaganda that is directed specifically at young people through a whole series of means, including the internet. Some of the things that we hear that go on in internet chat rooms tends to create this phenomenon of rapid onset gender dysphoria because the kids have been in the chat rooms talking with people who in some cases are posing as troubled teenagers, but they're really not. They're actually adults. So these kids are being induced to more or less attack their own body. You know, if you really think about it, to say I was born in the wrong body is to destabilize your own sense of identity. And so now you're vulnerable. Now you're sitting duck to anybody who comes along with an ideology and says, well, I'm your friend. Your parents don't understand you. Your pastor doesn't understand you. Join the gay club, you know, the LGBT club here on campus, and everybody will really like you now that you've discovered that you really are a boy. These are the kinds of things that we hear from the families, from the young people themselves, and from their families. This is a pattern that you often see. So what does that mean? It means you've broken down the family at the most basic level. You've driven a wedge between the child and the parents, and the state is taking the side of the child to wrest the child from the parent. And you've also driven a wedge between the child and their own body, right? You've destabilized the person's sense of identity, their sense of who they are. Well, if you're not sure who you are, you're vulnerable to people manipulating you and to telling you, oh, we're your friends. Oh, here's the truth. Oh, follow us, right? It's extremely insidious in that way. And so it's a more aggressive form of propaganda, I guess you could say, because it's really getting into the person's skull on a deeper level than anything that the communist propagandists of the 1930s would have been able to pull off.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is our guest on this Friday, December the 3rd. We're talking about gender, marriage, and socialism. When we come back, we'll spend a little more time with her and discuss what the fiscal and economic consequences of socialism's redefinition of marriage happened to be.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
in all things. Across the nation, children are back in over 1,800 Lutheran schools. Students are thriving in programs of excellence in safe, caring, Christian environments taught by dedicated teachers. To find a school in your community, visit lcms.org/schools. Contact a school today for information about a Lutheran school for the children in your family. That's lcms.org/schools.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Memoria Press's award-winning Latin programs are designed to teach your student to master Latin grammar through an easy-to-use step-by-step process. By studying Latin, your student will gain an academic vocabulary, a mastery of English grammar, and develop sound critical thinking skills. To order, visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next purchase by using the coupon code LPR22. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time. MemoriaPress.com.
Do you want your neighbors and community to see what you're celebrating this Christmas season? Why not display an outdoor nativity in front of your home or church? It's a great way to show others what Christmas is all about, the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ. Check out the Outdoor Nativity Store at OutdoorNativityStore.com. Durable, affordable, and American-made nativities. OutdoorNativityStore.com. OutdoorNativityStore.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about gender, marriage, and socialism with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse of the Ruth Institute. She's author of several books, including The Sexual State and a pamphlet titled The Socialist Attack on the Family. Jennifer, what are the fiscal and economic consequences of socialism's redefinition of marriage?
Well, you know, if you think about socialism just from an economics standpoint, you know, one of their objectives always was to control the economy and to bring more and more parts of the economy under the control of the state. So if you look at the breakdown of the family and ask, well, what are the economic consequences of breaking down the family? What you'll see is greater tax expenditures and greater regulatory powers being assigned to the state as a result of family breakdown. And in fact, the causality runs both directions. You could talk about just family breakdown itself. Okay, now you've got a mother with children. She can't take care of them as well. She needs social programs to help her. Those are taxpayer-funded programs. So the more people you have in that kind of situation, the greater demand is for tax payments. Then you've also got the whole phenomenon of no-fault divorce, by which the state takes sides with the person who wants the marriage the least. And here you have the state worming its way into the marriage relationship itself, basically, and separating the mother and father from each other, right? And the state always takes the side of the person who wants the marriage the least. That's what no-fault divorce actually means. Most people don't know that. You know, you should say that as often as you possibly can. The no-fault divorce means that the person who wants the marriage always loses. And there's no other contract, no other civil dispute of any kind that you can think of where one party always loses as a matter of law. You know, it's crazy. But then what that does is it opens the door for state involvement in the details of family life, including where the kids are going to spend Christmas, where the kids are going to go to school, how much time the children spend with each parent, how finances get allocated, where the kids are allowed to go to church. All kinds of things come under the purview of the family court, which is now the most socialist, in a sense. You know, if you think of socialism meaning the state control of the individual, the family courts are one of the most socialist institutions in society, and nobody says a word about it. So all of that factors into the overlap, the overlapping objectives of the economic side of socialism and the family breakdown aspect of cultural Marxism. All of that factors in together.
How does socialism politicize marriage?
Well, let's put it this way. Let's think about the advocates of socialism and what they're trying to accomplish. Okay, so the socialist ideology is a tool, and it's a tool in the hands of a certain set of people who are trying to do something. And if you're telling people that you absolutely must have equality in every aspect of life, including the relations between men and women inside your home, okay, what that form of we could call it feminism, we could call it socialism, whatever you want to call that, that doctrine will be familiar to many of your listeners, right? That we were all told that unless the household division of labor is 100% equal, 50-50, right down the middle, mother does the same tasks as the father, and if there's any inequality, it's unjust. Well, look at what that does to you. It means that we as women have an unlimited blank check for things to nag our husbands about. And I don't know about other ladies in the audience, but I didn't really need permission to do that. My mom didn't need permission to do that. We can do that all by ourselves, okay? But the point is, you could never satisfy that criteria. If you tried to do that, and my husband and I did try to do that for a long time. It was crazy. Before we had kids, we were trying to separate our finances and all the rest of it. You can never get to the bottom of equality. You can never make it so that everything's equal. And so you're going to be perpetually dissatisfied. So if you introduce that as the standard, then you're introducing conflict into marriages that would have a perfectly good chance of working and being fine marriages, right? If they had a reasonable standard to aspire to, they'd have a pretty good chance of having a happy life together. But by introducing that really impossible goal, what you're going to end up with is fighting, separation, and misery, unhappiness, people making each other, making themselves unhappy. And now you've broken down the family. Now you've got two households instead of one. Now you've got more people in poverty. Now you have more people attached more to the state than to one another. All that's perfect if your goal is to get people to be attached to the state and not to one another. So that's a big part of how that process works. You know, it's not just the law that is at work, but it's also these social practices that have been introduced by various forms of ideologues. Various kinds of ideologues, various aspects of this whole issue have made it just a lot harder for people to get married and stay married. So that's part of the answer to your question. It's obviously a multifaceted type of problem, especially now 40 or 50 years on, that these ideologies have been grinding through society pretty much unopposed by any serious institutional opposition.
You mentioned this before, cohabitation, no-fault divorce, out-of-wedlock births. We haven't talked about that one yet. What role do those three play in socialism's aim for marriage and the family?
Well, I mean, these are all things, these are all aspects of what I call the divorce ideology. Okay, in my book, The Sexual State, I lay out the sexual revolution as having three interlocking ideologies. And one of them is the divorce ideology, right? The divorce ideology says it doesn't really matter. You can separate sex and childbearing from marriage, and nothing bad will happen from doing that, okay? So the three things you mentioned, cohabitation, divorce, and non-marital childbearing, those are all ways in which a child comes into being and the relation between the mother and the father is unstable or was never stabilized or has been broken down. And so what you're really saying is that that doesn't matter to the child. Nothing bad is going to happen to the child. Well, in fact, we now know from lots and lots of experience that it's devastating for children when their parents break up. It's very difficult. And the repartnering is even worse. That brings about what we call multi-partner fertility and what, of course, Jesus called adultery. If you remember Matthew 19, it was the remarriage that Jesus was telling people not to do. What that means is that the foundation of the child's personality and the child's sense of identity becomes destabilized. Okay, so your child going from one house to the next every week, okay, which is the fate of many children of divorce. A child having no contact at all with their father, which is the fate of many children of unmarried parents. If their parents are never married, they never have a relationship with their father. And certainly sperm donor children literally never have a relationship with their father. Cohabiting couples end with much more instability in their relationships. And so what that means is that the child who grows up under those circumstances, and I'm not saying every child has every single problem on the big laundry list of things that are more likely to happen, but it is a fact that children who grew up in those circumstances are more likely to have a whole variety of difficulties in living, many of which are going to require further intervention by the state to manage, whether it's special ed, whether it's extra medical care, extra psychological care. All these kinds of issues are more likely to take place. And you've built up the power of the state. The father has been replaced by the state. So obviously you're moving power and money and influence from the private civil society sector and moving it into the governmental public sector. That's what all of those things have the tendency to do. So that's part of it. And the other thing that you can know is, you know, you can look back to the 60s and you can see people like Clower and Piven, who wrote a famous book about the welfare state and so on. These are leftists, you know, and they went around to people and basically told them, look, there's no shame in you taking welfare. There's no shame having your babies without being married. They literally went around and broke down the work ethic of the poor. They went around and broke down the moral ethic of the poor and told them it didn't matter, you know, because their goal was to get as many people on welfare as possible. Their goal, which they explicitly stated, was to have so many people on welfare that the whole capitalist system would collapse and you could start all over and have a wonderful, glorious socialist system. So they literally broke down the ethics that were common to everybody of every class in order to achieve this objective. It used to be that poor people and rich people and everybody had an opportunity to live with both of their parents for their whole childhood. You know, that used to be the norm. And that was deliberately taken away, starting with poor people. And now we're to the point where that opportunity to live with both parents for your whole childhood, that's almost vanished from many, many sectors of our society.
When we come back with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse, as we discuss gender, marriage, and socialism, how does Christianity present an obstacle to socialism's aims for marriage? Thanks to our beloved on-demand listeners, Issues Etc. consistently ranks among the top podcasts in religion and spirituality. You can help us climb the charts by subscribing, rating, and reviewing Issues Etc. Type Issues Etc. in your podcast provider, hit the subscription button, and leave us a 5-star review. This will make it easier for podcast listeners to find Issues Etc. Help us cast Christ's net on the internet. Subscribe, rate, and review Issues Etc. today.
Providing artillery support for the church militant on the front lines, you're listening to Issues Etc.
Are you looking for Christ-focused ornaments and gifts this Advent? Ad Crucem has a wide selection of Christmons, Christmas ornaments, greeting cards, artwork, housewares, jewelry, and churchwares to boldly and beautifully proclaim the good news of Christ given for us. Put what you believe, teach, and confess on display this year. Visit adcrucem.com. That's adcrucem.com.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about gender, marriage, and socialism with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse. You can help us contend for truth in an age of anti-truth by making a year-end tax-deductible donation to Issues Etc. With 5 weeks left in 2021, we're $192,000 short of expenses. Any size gift is deeply appreciated. You can make a secure online contribution at issuesetc.org. Or by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Thanks for listening and thanks for your vital support at the end of the year. Jennifer, how does Christianity present an obstacle to socialism's aims for marriage?
Well, you know, first of all, Christianity is organized around completely different principles. I mean, Jesus never promised us heaven on earth. And socialism is trying to promise heaven on earth. And Jesus promised us persecution. He promised us heaven in heaven. See? So they're obviously going to be at loggerheads with each other. And if you simply look at it on the material level, socialism is going to look like a better deal because, like, oh, wow, we're getting heaven here and he's giving us persecution. Well, I'm going to go with these guys. Well, the problem is it's literally a deal with the devil, you know, because they never deliver what they promise. And what Christianity is telling you is that man does not live by bread alone. Man is meant for love. The human person is meant for love. And if you notice, in the socialist conception of the family, there's no room for love. Love is a construct. Love is the cover story for a power grab in the socialist mindset. But in Christianity, love is a real thing. And Jesus went first. He's not telling us that we got to do anything that he didn't do. You know, he died on the cross. We can at least pick up our socks, you know. And so the two worldview visions are completely at odds with one another. And what people have to ask themselves is, do you want to live in a world of love or not? And what the Christian sexual ethics does is it protects the rights of children to be in relationship with both of their parents. And it does that better than any of the modern systems that anybody's been able to come up with. Because the Christian sexual ethic says, you get married and you stay married, and you only have sex with the person you're married to. And that's going to protect the interests of children to be with both of their parents. And by the way, another thing Christian sexual ethics says is, you got to be nice to your spouse. You can't just go nagging and complaining, and whatever theory you might have of male dominance in the household, Christianity does not say that the husband gets to boss the wife around at random. And Christianity does not say that the wife gets to nag and whine and complain at her husband. You know, I mean, being nice to your spouse was always part of the package that Christianity demanded of us. And that's what people have to ask themselves. It's the comprehensive vision that is offered by Christian sexual ethics versus what is being offered to us by the package of socialism plus the sexual revolution. How do you really want to live? You know, do you want to live in a world that has lust instead of love? That's the question.
Expand on that a little bit. How does Christianity present a superior definition of marriage and then, by extension, of larger society built upon marriage and family?
Yeah, so, I mean, the understanding of marriage is that it's an analogy between Christ and the church. You know, we know that from Ephesians, right? And that there's a hierarchy within family life. But the thing is held together with love. And the hierarchy is not a dominance. It's not a power grab. It's mutual service, okay? And so the rights and responsibilities that husbands and wives have towards each other are in a kind of balance, you know? And it's not supposed to be a power struggle. And then part of the rights and responsibilities have to do with your rights and responsibilities towards children. You don't get to go off with a new boyfriend or a new girlfriend just because you feel like it and somebody told you that your kids were resilient and they'd be fine. None of that's true, you know. So that's part of it. But the other part of it is that what Christianity says is that if you're going to be married for life to somebody, we as women, I'll just speak as a woman, we as women can have seasons in our lives. We can have a period of time where we're not working full time. And this was something that was hard for me to really fully embrace. But once I got the idea, it worked really well, you know, because when my kids first arrived, I was trying to do my teaching job at the university in part-time hours and take care of my kids so that I could be equal to my colleagues at the university and so that I could be equal with my husband at home. Everything would be shared and even Stephen. And it was crazy. You know, it made me crazy. It wasn't good for the kids. It was too much work. And so it finally became clear that if I could entrust myself to my husband and not be afraid that he might leave me or something, I could stay home with the kids. And, well, that's what I did. And he became grateful that I was taking care of the kids, that we had a nicer home, that we had more peace in our home. He was grateful when I was available to take care of his mother. When his mother became sick and needed a place to live, she stayed with us, with me and our kids and my husband and my brother-in-law. And if I had been working, that wouldn't have been possible. Okay. And so now that period of my life, our life is over. Kids are grown. Grandma's deceased. That period is over. So now I can do something else. And guess what? He's extremely supportive of me and the Ruth Institute. He's now retired. I'm taking care of him. He's having a ball. And I'm quote unquote working at something that I really love. And none of that would have been possible if I had been nagging him about household chores for 30 years, you see. None of that could have happened. But in order for that to get started, it has to be the case that divorce is off the table. You cannot be worried about day to day, oh my gosh, is today the day he's going to walk out? Because if you're thinking like that, you're going to stay in the workplace longer than you really want to be in the workplace, right? You're going to go, well, you know, I can only have as many kids as I can take care of myself as a single mom. And yeah, so I'm just going to keep right on working. And well, the kids aren't as well off as they would be, but oh well, that's what I got to do. You know, that's how non-Christians in today's society have to think. That's the kind of strategic thinking that they have to do, which is not based on love. You see, it's based on fear. And I just want to say to the audience that when I wrote this pamphlet in 2008, I didn't know how this was going to turn out. I hoped it would turn out the way it did. But the fact is, it's working great. And only the Christian ethos could make that really possible. That's what I want to say to people.
So how does Christianity's vision of marriage benefit a free society at large?
Well, look, if you've got kids who don't know who they are, and you've got kids who aren't sure if their parents love them and who aren't sure where they're going to be from one week to the next, okay, you're going to have a lot of instability within the personality itself. And, you know, again, when I first started writing this area 20 years ago now with Love and Economics, I was concerned about the development of the conscience and the fact that children need stable attachments and secure attachments to their parents in order to develop a conscience. Without a conscience, if you got too many people who don't have a conscience, you really can't have a free society, because you're going to have to be dealing with people who are doing anything that they think they can get away with, who are not attached to anybody, who aren't thinking about anything except themselves and what they want. You can't monitor all those people very well, right? And so you're going to have to invest a lot in some combination of prisons and protection and remediation in order to overcome the presence of large numbers of people who have poorly formed consciences. So that's the fundamental reason, I would say, of why a free society really is relying on mothers and fathers to raise their children in a personal way, to raise their children in such a way that the children have secure attachments so that they can grow up to be responsible adults who can use their freedom without bothering other people too much.
You began our conversation hearkening back to the fall of communism and socialism in the former Soviet Union, where many, as you said, assumed obviously failed experiment in every facet of society and the economy. But you said socialism just changed its target from economic to the family. Is there a point coming in American society where people will see, and perhaps it's a generation that did not witness the previous failures of socialism for themselves, where they see that this is doomed to fail husbands, wives, children, and our society?
Well, I hope so. I hope people can see that it isn't working. I hope people will stop thinking, well, gee, if we just tweak this a little bit, it'll be okay, you know. But whether that happens or whether we go all the way into the abyss, Todd, that depends on us. That depends on what we do and don't do, you know. If we just hope it collapses on its own, it'll collapse all right, but it won't collapse in any way that anybody's going to like, you know. If we're going to put a stop to this, Christians are going to have to be intentional. Christians are going to have to be articulate. We're going to have to fight. You know, we're going to have to put up positive resistance. If you don't actively resist, this thing is going to sweep you away. And going along to get along, there are just way too many individuals, way too many churches, way too many Christian institutions that have rolled with the times way too much. And we've lost control of a lot of those institutions. So it's by no means obvious what will happen. What will happen depends entirely on what we choose to do and not do. So I'd say, people, you need to get yourself geared up spiritually so that you have the will to resist. You need to get yourself geared up intellectually so that you know how to resist. But we cannot take for granted that just because it's failing, and it's, you know, it's obviously failing all around us, that that's enough to generate a good outcome. By itself, it will not generate a good outcome.
Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris is founder and president of the Ruth Institute. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities. She's senior research fellow in economics for the Acton Institute and author of several books, including The Sexual State and a pamphlet titled The Socialist Attack on the Family. You can purchase these resources at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk on Demand Archives. Jen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Todd.
Cheryl DeWitt of Redeeming Life Outreach will join us on the other side to talk about helping women considering abortion and maternity homes. Stay tuned. With 5 weeks left in 2021, we need $192,000 to cover our expenses for the year. Please make a year-end tax-deductible gift to support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. You can contribute by check, make your check payable to Issues Etc., and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of Issues Etc. at the end of the year.
For nearly 140 years, the Lutheran Witness has taught the faith, defended it against error, and shown forth the great treasures of the Lutheran Church and biblical doctrine. We're continuing this legacy by publishing issues and articles that help you see the world from a Lutheran perspective and that teach biblical doctrine and show forth the treasures of God's Word. Visit our website to learn more and how to subscribe, witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
We're supported by listeners like you. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're looking for a Christmas gift for a child, grandchild, or godchild ages 3 through 8, give them the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, Symbols of Salvation, The Story of Jesus' Birth. It's a new, interactive, and illustrated book showcasing the true story of Christmas in rhyme. Symbols of Salvation is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or browse before you buy at issuesetc.org. Symbols of Salvation, the Issues Etc. Book of the Month.